should make you nervous when the preacher brings a stack of books to the pulpit.
I forgot this announcement, but for some of you that are, in the storytelling group, and I don't know if you've got the outline of James Fallow's Tapestry to help organize your story and narrative, and if you didn't, I've got some extra copies up here. We also just finished in our book reading group Tom Hartman's book, Unequal Power, How Corporations Got the Right as Persons, and recently the Supreme Court made a decision that corporations could contribute as much money as they wanted because they have the rights of persons, and it kind of woke a lot of people up. But what this book is tells about this story, that this story began pre-Revolutionary War. I mean, this story began in 1600 and has carried on. So there's a long history to that Supreme Court decision. This book was great. And we decided to have resolution to a few conflicts, as Tony suggested, the UUA with fisticuffs. No, we didn't. But it was a fairly intense discussion and good discussion about that history, and surprising. This is the next book we're going to read for next month, Embodying Spirit, Jacqueline Small, kind of a Jungian spiritual perspective. It's a lot different than the corporation book. And here's a book for how to become depressed. If you read this book, A Diet for New America, written in 1987. And it's like one of those books you read. I've read Eric Fromm, and I read his book. He wrote it in 1943, one of his books, Escape from Freedom. And I'm reading it, and it's like he wrote it today. And this book is like that. You read it, even though it was decades ago, but you're thinking, you know, they're talking about today. You know, it's true. And leading that book, A Diet for New America, leading up to not just the sermon today, but my hope is, in following the leadership of the Unitarian Universalist Association, that we take hold of this issue that they chose, that we're not going to study for the usual 2 years of our social conscious issue, but we're going to study it for 4 years. And so that it's not just a sermon, but it's something that we study and we look at and we incorporate and digest ethical eating, and really ponder about throughout the years. And the topic is ethical eating. And as I say that, ethical eating, you know, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? Ethical eating. You know, what does that mean? What is that about? And, well, it could mean anything for anybody, and we're going to talk about that to the differences, what it might mean to us, and what it might mean to us as a group of people. But I was reminded of a story when I first started thinking about this. I was back in the 1980s. I was living in Denver, Colorado, and I was working construction, and I was going to go pick up a fellow who was helping me work on that Saturday morning, and came up to his house, and he had a fence, and his dog was eating over here, a chow. And so I'm bold and young and brash, you know, I didn't think nothing of it. So I just walk in the gate, and I was about four feet away from the dog, and the dog attacked me. And I was looking at it, my leg this morning. I said, "Yeah, there's those two, they're still there." And when we're talking about ethical eating, I'm aware I may get bit by talking up habits of eating. And so I'm aware of that. And we'll get to a little bit that more in a minute, that when we start talking about things about our habits, our rituals, our eating, how we deal with anxiety, how we deal with comfort, how we deal with our value systems, what things we're proud of, not proud of. I mean, you remember the bumper sticker, "Took me this long to get on top of the food chain. I'll be daggoned if I'm going to give up beef." You know, and I wonder who put that bumper sticker out. But anyway, You know, but those words are incorporated in us and in our thoughts and our maps to how we understand the world. And here we are going to talk about ethical eating, and we're going to talk about something that's very personal, our eating habits. It's very personal how it affects our body. I was remembering my father was about 80 and struggling with diabetes, and he's a stubborn fella. And so I was over at his house the other day, and for whatever reason, they've got Easter candy there, and, you know. And so now I'm role reversal a little bit, and I say, "Hey, Dad, you can't eat that." So he takes this pure sugar thing that looks like a bunny rabbit, and pops it in his mouth. Is that an ethical eating issue? That's a thought. Is that an ethical? You know, recently we have been talking about a spiritual transformation. And in the spiritual transformation, I brought up those four principles. And one of the four principles in spiritual transformation was an awareness of the other, the ethic of the other. And in as highly individualistic as a culture as we are, and the second half of the sermon is ethical eating, don't mess with a man's poison. And deliberately use man at that particular time. Don't mess with the poison. Don't mess with the sugar. You know, don't mess with what we eat. Don't mess with what I have found comforting in this world. And so then, in this hyper-individualistic culture, we look at ethical eating. So I raise the question, when we're talking about the ethic of the other and we're talking about the web of existence, are my eating habits purely my decision alone? Are my eating habits purely my decision alone? Is my health purely an individualistic issue? I recently, two years ago, had an uncle who died, and a week before he died, he said to me, "I can't believe I let my body get into this shape." Now, most of the people in my family are in their 80s, and he was 68. And he was a clinician, and I could talk to him, and he had a position in our family, and it was a position of responsibility and a resource and wisdom, and we loved him and we cared about him. And he's telling me, he says, "You know, when I get out of the hospital, I'm going to do something different with my body, because I can't believe I let it get here." And he died. And I'm angry, you know, and I take on that responsibility. No, his habits affect more than him. He's not just an individual. He's part of a family system. He's part of a community. He's a resource. He's got wisdom. He's an enjoyable person. He's an enjoyable person to be around. And how we treat ourselves physically and how we treat ourselves bodily, it's not an individual decision. It's a family decision. It's a community decision. It's all of our decisions. So when we start talking about ethical eating and I say, "Wait a minute, what are you eating?" And you know, and Helen will, she probably wouldn't tell you this, but I'll tell you because she wouldn't tell you. If I stop at a store, say we're going home, and you know, favorite little bag of popcorn kind of things, favorite white cheddar, 10,000 milligrams of salt. I mean, it's just unbelievable. You know, by the time I go to the store, and I've already got the image in my mind of the object, right? I've already got it in my head when I go into the store, which is already a problem, right? So I go in the store and I get it, and I come back and I start the car, and she picks up and she just starts reading it. I'm lost, right? And she's right.
Magical moment.
Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, you know. But I want it to work. I'm appreciative of the care. But the way the human mind works, at that moment, that's an aggravation. That's an aggravation. You know, with and working with folks and understanding life of addictions, you know, somebody's struggling with alcohol and they don't want to drink that night, usually they've made the decision whether they're going to drink that night or not at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Yeah. Yeah. The image and the desire is already there, and then everything in between 1 o'clock and 7 o'clock is orchestrated around that time to achieve the image and that goal and the feeling state that went along with it. Now, why is that important when we're talking about ethical eating? I mean, we could say ethical eating. We could go to the global issues and global hunger and kind of stay out there. We could think of Haiti, and I think of Haiti, and I think of all the rescuing and compassion and empathy we had for Haiti. But 4 months earlier, when they were saying that people in Haiti were eating mud cakes, but we didn't, you know, so different things happen to us and arouse our passions, and it has to do around eating, that's another story, and it could deal with factory farming, ethical eating in a factory farming, or the farming of the fish where they have greater fat now, and they go out in there and they get mercury in them, and then they contaminate. I mean, just all kind of crazy things that we don't pay attention to when we're thinking about ethical eating. I think before we can have this conversation, because it is so personal, body, mind, spirit, it affects our emotional life, it affects our economic system, it affects climate change. Do you know if we stopped, and I'm not saying do it, well, yeah, go ahead and do it, but if we stop eating meat today, half the pollution and half the global change that we contribute to this country, as to the world as a nation, would go away? Just like that. Instantly. Go away. But we're not going to do that. Why are we going to do that? We know what's good for us. I know sugar's not good for me, but yet I eat it. You know, I know a meditative way of life is good for me, and I know that walking regular is good for me, and I know that using the sauna is good for me, and when I'm really good, I got this pattern, and I can really manage my blood pressure really well, and I know the pattern that'll do that. And I've developed the consciousness of that. Now I'm saying at 55, it's a greater concern. And I would say that 65, 70% of the time, I can get it. You know, but other times I don't. Why don't I? I know. Why is that not 100%? So I think before we can even have the conversation as a community and as individuals as ethical eating, we got to ask ourselves a couple questions. Am I available for change? Do I have the capacity to change? Am I available for transformation? Do I have the capacity for transformation? I was thinking, just looking at our nation, and in the 70s, there was a threat to the ozone layer, with fluorocarbons, and the refrigeration. And the nation, and scientists, and politicians took that new information in and said, whoa, this is a problem, because this could destroy the ozone layer. He comes in and could destroy the world. And they acted. They took new information in and they adapted, and, you know, so the problem decreased. And I'm thinking about the world today. We get new information in that's really problematic stuff, but we're fighting the change. And why? So if you remember a sermon about maybe a year, that's asking a lot, isn't it? Maybe not. That we looked at how the brain works. And we looked at a theory which has some good stuff to it, I think, about the triune brain, about the reptilian brain, the limbic brain, and the neocortex, how the brain works. And in that sermon, I was kind of making a point, but also kind of making fun, that we could use just our reptilian brain characteristics, which I'll read some of them in a minute, and we would function just fine on this planet. I mean, we really don't have to use the mammalian and the neocortex. I mean, listen to the aspects of the reptilian brain. Selection and preparation for a home site. Establishment of domain or territory. Now, we also know today that human beings, the establishment of a domain and territory, that's just not physical. Human beings establish domain, this reptilian brain, without reflection, without meaning-making, without using symbols and symbol lab and thinking and expanding our thought, that the domain of territory we know as humans in our imaginations, we'll have a belief system territory that's locked into place that there's no hope for it to change or transform if we don't use our neocortex. And when we run into belief system that says our climate's in trouble and the world's not adjusting to the trouble that our climate's into, I'm going, we're stuck in the reptilian brain system because we're not adapting. Not like we did in the 60s, 70s. We're stuck. We're not using, so something's going on while we're not using that. So when we look at domain and territory, not just domain and territory physical, but domain and territory in our imaginative processes, in our value systems, in our belief systems, in our religious belief systems, in our values as Unitarian Universalists. If we're stuck in there and we can't change and can't shift, that's a problem. The routinizing of daily activities. What was that children's story about? We're so busy and our time's so tight, we just do it and do it and do it and do it. The rat race, we just run the reel and over and over and over again. Well, that's not human, that's the reptilian brain. And the establishment of the social hierarchy and flocking and migration. I think of migration, I think of some people in a congregation I love. They're going to be soon migrating. You know, I'm thinking, wow, that's, you know, this is it. It's what we do, isn't it? It's warmer, it's colder, we shift around. Then we have in the limbic system, we have the association of events with emotions, the organization of events, and the emotions in our memory. That's the limbic system, where we organize our narrative, we organize our story, we organize our cultural symbols, and we attach emotion to those symbols and to those events and memories. And so that's the limbic system. And then the neocortex, what really makes us human. What really makes us human, what really enables us to look at our situation and look at who we are as human beings and change and transform and to become different. The neocortex is where we use symbols and we have symbol elaboration and they move and they grow and we reflect on our own lives and we make meaning out of our own lives. I don't know if you've ever had an experience where somebody would say something to you, you know, you do this. And you would say, no, I don't. And they'd say, yes, you do. You do do it. And you would say, no, I don't. Yes, you do. No, I don't. Yes, you do. No, I don't. Has anybody ever said, when I got into counseling, you know, Gregory, you're indirect with your anger? No, I'm not indirect with my anger. What are you talking about? Then I say, maybe I am. And then they would say, well, how come you're indirect with your anger? Where does that come from? That's not a genetic predisposition, being indirect with your anger. That's an environmental issue. Well, how come you're indirect? And I say, well, I don't know. And they say, well, let's go back and look at your history. That's human to do that. That's human to do that. And to say, oh, no wonder there was anger in my childhood environment. I was not the oldest. I was the youngest. So I did not have the power to go up against that anger. So I had to either be indirect with my anger or swallow my anger and repression and go do something else. That's human to do that. To reflect and make meaning and then to learn that if I want to be who I could be in this world to be my best or to be really available for intimacy in a relationship and to be close in a relationship, I had to do something about that. And then when I did something about that, that's transformation. That's change. That's a vulnerability in my life. But it's different. But then I become different. The capacity to change. And the question is, do we as a community and do we as a people and do I as an individual and do you as individuals and people in relationship with one another, do we have the capacity to change? Do we have the capacity for transformation? If we don't, there's no need to have the conversation about ethical eating.
When we read the outline that the UUA, and we will, writes down of the areas that they want for topic for discussion for ethical eating, and you look at that and how involved that is in our health, in our economic system, in our transportation system, in the pollution system, in the degradation of our environment, and deforestation, and the amount of energy that's used when there's another way. There is another way that's not as damaging to us as people, not as damaging to the planet. There is another way. If we don't have the capacity to change, then this conversation really would be a waste of time. So I have to ask myself, even before I engage the conversation, and have asked myself in the past couple of weeks, am I willing to do things differently? Because if we engage in this conversation, the conclusion is we need to do things differently. We can't get around it. We're going to need to do things differently. So that means my cherished way of eating, thinking, value system, belief system, all that's going to come under question. And I have to be okay with that. Okay. Let's do it. And so as we continue on for this next couple years looking at this issue is about spiritual transformation. This issue is about changing who we are as a people and a community and how we think and how we participate with one another. Okay. Let's take the invitation that our UUA leaders have given us and let's engage this conversation and take a look at it for who we are as a people.